Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Legendary Mavis Staples singing one of the anthems of what we think of today as the Civil Rights Movement. But what was the prize that hundreds of thousands of people from all walks of life had their eyes on 50 years ago? The people from all over America who were part of the March on Washington. It culminated in the immortal pictures of protest, democracy, and racial equality. What was the prize? They were willing to drop everything to come at their own expense to the nation's capital and demand that they were willing to face police, the FBI, and the entire U.S. government to obtain.
Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens. But those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act, but what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white?
For labor activists, you can hear him there, A. Philip Randolph, the March on Washington was the culmination of more than two decades of confronting American economic inequality. Even though we remember the March on Washington for the soaring poetry of Martin Luther King's dream of racial justice, it is economic justice that remains the elusive prize. William Jones is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. He's professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Jones, welcome.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be here.
So remind us of A. Philip Randolph. He was such a central figure in 1963, barely remembered today.
That's right. If you look at the publicity for the March on Washington, Life magazine, for example, carried a picture of A. Philip Randolph on its cover right after the march. He was the official director of the march. He had, as you mentioned, first called for a March on Washington in 1941. He was widely known as the dean of the civil rights movement at the time. And it would not be until later, actually until after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that Martin Luther King and his I Have a Dream speech would be primarily identified as the message of the march.
Until then, there's this unity of civil rights and this challenge to American capitalism that I think gets lost in our understanding of what happened in 1963, but certainly was part of what made people so nervous about that march in Washington in August of 1963.
That's right. But, A. Philip Randolph, when he first called for the march in 1941, was routinely blasted in the news media. He was called the most dangerous Negro in America. And he retained something of that reputation in the 1960s. He was a prominent figure in the Socialist Party and in the labor movement and identified as a radical.
Did an economic coalition that really was building across the country as you got to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, did that fall apart? Was it sort of grafted away or surgically removed to support this sort of pure vision of racial justice, the civil rights movement as we remember today, all of the economic reforms sort of forgotten after the march?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that's our memory, but I don't think that's actually an accurate way in which people would have perceived it at the time. In fact, the most important demand of the march for most of the people who participated in it was the creation of what at the time was known as a Fair Employment Practices Law, making it illegal to discriminate against somebody on the basis of their race or their national origin, their religion.
And that included employers and unions, right?
That's right. It covered private employers and unions. So it was at this time it was seen as a very radical move. And that became Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and was really, I think, probably the central achievement of the march, to take a law that had actually already been introduced by Kennedy 2 months before the march, but Kennedy did not support the Fair Employment Law. It later became known as the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And that, I think, you know, that still remains a really important part of our legal framework.
You know, you quote Hubert Humphrey as saying that he didn't believe, and there were a lot of skeptical lawmakers in Washington in August of 1963, that even Hubert Humphrey didn't believe many votes were changed on the Civil Rights Act. It took the assassination of JFK and the mobilization by Lyndon Johnson to get a Civil Rights Act. But I'm wondering if the economic reforms in the war on poverty, aside from the Fair Employment Practices Act that you've described, really fade into the distance, and we're not having the same debates today.
Well, again, I would point to the war on poverty. Probably the most important legacy of the war on poverty was Medicare and Medicaid, which had a tremendous impact on lowering poverty rates in the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, we are having a debate over a national healthcare system. I don't think that those things were forgotten, but I do think we forget that they were part of the civil rights agenda.
The Reagan Revolution, I think, enshrines American capitalism with the idea of being equal to freedom, and that was not understood that way in 1963.
That's right. The principle, I think the idea that jobs came first, it was jobs and freedom, and the idea was that that in order to be equal, you have to have a decent standard of living and also not be competing with other people who feel their standard of living is threatened.
William Jones is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. He's also a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, more on economic justice and the modern civil rights movement. What prize do you have your eyes on? Kimberly from Texas writes, "Thumbs up. I am living the American dream. I own a business. I don't have enough money to do everything I want, but I have the opportunity to earn it. I can vote, and I do what I can to make my community a better place for all." But Tyrone says, "No, I'm not living it. I'm trying to get to it. Ever since getting laid off in 2007, and this is the Great Recession of 2008, it's been an uphill battle ever since." He's one of you from Baltimore. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us. Hold on. Hold on. Nowhere is the goal of economic justice and equality more unmet, the promise of economic opportunity in America unkept, than in the community of Youngstown, Ohio. Once a center of American manufacturing, it lost its steel factories in the 70s, and in a second wave of plant closings, lost its remaining manufacturing in the 1990s. While the March on Washington was motivated on trying to make sure everyone shared in the American prosperity of the 20th century, perhaps the new prize is making sure America doesn't simply forget about people displaced by an economy that has been in flux since the recession of 2008. Activist and organizer Tammy Thomas Miles walks in the footsteps of A. Philip Randolph. Today she uses the techniques of political engagement and advocacy to carry on a struggle of radical change that most Americans would dismiss today as impossible. For Tammy, the March on Washington is not a dream, it's essential. Democracy's ultimate prize, and she means to get it.
It's very hard to have a conversation about the economy and not talk about race. It's very hard to talk about one without the other, because oftentimes the folks that are left at the bottom when industries move out and jobs leave, a lot of the folks that are stuck left in those communities are usually people of color and people who live in poverty. So I think that those are bases to talk about race and gender.
In your personal story, you were a very successful factory worker, member of a union. But at a certain point, you took a step really to become an activist when most of your life told you that all you needed to do was keep your head down and everything would be fine. How did you make that transition?
Well, our company filed bankruptcy for one thing. So, you know, I'm going to be honest, I prayed about what the next step was. And then living in this community and seeing so many wrongs and so much injustice and the fact that I had to actually feel like I had to raise my kids to move away, and they did that, like that kind of stayed unsettling with me. So when I was approached with the idea of actually taking a turn to do something to actually push against people who can actually make a change, or to build power amongst people who can make change in a community for themselves and not just have things done for them, it became very interesting.
The civil rights movement is something we understand in a historical context, and the civil rights leaders are often viewed as a generation that had their moment, and that moment has passed in some sense. The labor movement is dwindling in terms of numbers. Do you see your organizing as a part of the civil rights movement and a part of the union movement, or something fundamentally different, a new kind of organization, a new kind of community activism?
I see it as both, actually. I think that the work that we do in our communities on the local level, on a statewide level, and nationally, and in comparison to the civil rights movement, yes, it's about mobilization, and it is about all the work that goes on the side. The civil rights movement fight is still happening, but it's like it's happening in churches. It's happening in community centers and in backyards. And how do we make sure that that grassroots movement piece is elevated and it has a much larger voice, and it's not just one, two, or three significant key leaders?
What would you say is a harder job from your perspective? Getting the Civil Rights Act to be the law of the land back in 1965, or developing a program that's going to give felons in Youngstown, Ohio, an opportunity to work?
Oh, my gosh. That's like a loaded question, John. Well, I'll say this. We don't have dogs being sicked on us. We're not being water hosed, right? But we are being shot down in our communities. We do have stringent gun laws that are being imposed by legislators in different states across the country. And we don't have adequate access to jobs. So as far as which would be harder, you know, it's a fight in a different way. They're just being cut down in a different manner. And it is affecting the next generation after that. So I'm not sure that one fight is harder than the other. I think they're just fought in a different manner.
Do you think Youngstown will ever be prosperous again? And if so, will political activism be the agent of change? What has to happen in Youngstown?
I do think that Youngstown is turning. I don't think it's at that tipping point yet. I think that political activism has to be a part of it. But I also think that it's a coming together of folks. It's a coming together. It's a education process about how some of these issues, like voting rights, how that affects everyone. I believe that through the work that we're doing and educating folks around these issues and it being value-based, when people are looking at the next steps for Youngstown, that it becomes more important about what a person is saying and doing and holding them accountable than what political party they're coming from.
Mm.
I think it's going to be more important for churches and unions and community people and social service agencies and folks that work, you know, that are government related, that we're able to come to the table and have these discussions together, and that grassroots people are at the table where decisions are being made. I think that's how Youngstown turns around.
If there was a march on Washington today, certainly the original march on Washington was about a goal that was really clear: equality, racial equality in America. And there are all kinds of taglines and memorable phrases from that time. What would it be today, Tammy?
I think race would still be a part of it. Gender would be a part of it. But it would definitely deal with the economy, with the inequalities that exist in our economy. It would have to be a conversation that talks about flipping who's constantly winning in this country. And who's constantly winning in this country is not the everyday average person. Who's constantly winning is usually the folks that are very, very out of touch with the average, everyday, regular person.
What's the next generation going to feel about organizers, the civil rights movement, all of these politically active movements that are so much a part of our history. Is it going to mean anything to them?
I pray about that, because with this whole Trayvon Martin thing, like, I've heard these stories where kids are saying, like, you know, my life doesn't matter. I'm not valuable. But then before Trayvon Martin, you know, I would talk to seniors, and seniors were saying, you know, I don't feel like I'm valued, or I don't have anything to add because my time, you know, I'm old. I would hope that the next generation sees community organizing as a way to actually bring folks of all different genders and backgrounds and ages and have these intergenerational conversations that are for them. You know, I would hope that they see that political activism is something that's directly connected to them.
Tammy Thomas Miles, senior organizer for the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative and the Ohio Organizing Collaborative. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read more about the extraordinary life of Tammy Thomas Miles. She's one of the people profiled in the amazing book by journalist George Packer, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can catch up on this conversation, listen back to anything you hear on the show. Visit us at thetakeaway.org or find us on facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.